Welcome everybody to episode 27 of the Blue Skies Dronecast, the podcast by UAV Hub. This is a podcast for the UK drone industry discussing everything from the UK regulations, new drones, and also speaking to you, the people within the drone industry. Presented this week by Tom Patterson and Matthew Hare. So welcome along everyone to episode 27, a cold, dreary day as we're recording this. So again, I think we've got a storm coming, so I don't think I can say hopefully the weather improves, because I don't think it's going to. So it's going to get a lot worse, and hopefully everyone will keep safe during the couple of days when we've got pretty strong winds, I think, happening. So yeah, we'll keep an eye on that. But we've got Matthew today. Adam is unfortunately unwell. He's been struck down by a winter cold or winter bug, or the one that's sort of going around. I think he went to a Christmas market and that was it. He got infected, unfortunately. So he's all right, but you wouldn't really want to see him on video or listen to him either, actually, by the sounds of things. So I think we'll carry on. But we've got Matthew here as always. So yeah, Matthew, how you doing? You've had a few days off, haven't you? Have you been doing some more racing?
I have indeed, yes, Tom. Yeah, thanks for the welcome. Yeah, it's been a nice little break. I made the most of it and went out and put in a good performance over this weekend for a change. So you may have noticed I've been a bit more quiet about it recently, and that maybe is subconsciously because things haven't gone quite my way in the last couple of events. But yeah, Sunday was super. The weather was absolutely horrendous, but we soldiered on anyway. Sort of pre-competition, there were about 25 entries, and I think about 12 arrived because of the weather. So we soldiered on anyway. Fought through the drizzle, I think just about everything but snow, but yeah, cold, drizzly, windy, horrible day, but yeah, we got some results, and yeah, it was a super day out, so feeling good about that.
Brilliant. Yeah, so would they just out of interest, would they postpone it if the wind was too much, or is it kind of a obviously you've got probably a much higher wind limit with these aircraft anyway, but I guess it's kind of the go or no-go decision still has to happen at some point, does it, I suppose?
Or? Yeah, that's right. So if it's forecast to be way outside of what's sort of comfortably flyable, then the event would have been cancelled ahead of time. But when everybody arrives on site, if let's assume there's sort of a good handful of people that are happy to go ahead, then the organiser ultimately makes the call on site. And in this case, he did chat to a couple of people, and the competition director, the CD, ultimately makes the call as to whether it's to go ahead or not. And of course, individually, each pilot has the option of pulling out as well. So there is a limit. There is sort of a specified limit of wind speed and so on. But ultimately, it comes down to whether or not the competitors want to take part.
Yeah. That's it, I guess. It's a little bit different to sort of commercial work, isn't it, I guess, because the whole area will be pretty safe. And like we were sort of mentioning before we recorded, the worst case is, I guess, you lose the aircraft, which is not very nice, but not as dangerous as, you know, flying over a crowd and having a problem or something
exactly
like that.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, the way things are laid out, as you say, it's very, very safe. It's just the equipment at risk. It's not to say that an accident could never happen. So for that reason, of course, it is all insured as well. But yeah, it's very unlikely that anybody could ever be injured. And as you say, a couple of aircraft did meet their fate yesterday, but fortunately none of mine.
Not yours though. Yeah, that's it. That's the main thing, isn't it? Brilliant. No, that's good. It's always nice to keep up with what you're doing in your spare time, which is always good, and hopefully the listeners agree as well. So without further ado, I think we'll kick off with this episode, and hopefully you've seen in sort of the title or the description, we've got a couple of subjects we're going to cover. The first one is was a bit of a shocker, actually. I think the drone insurance company Flock have decided to not be in the drone industry anymore, which I think is quite an interesting one. So we'll talk about that and kind of explain sort of maybe how it happened or why it happened, and sort of the alternatives, I suppose, now, because we do have a lot of students and probably a lot of other people listening using their services. So it is quite interesting that that is no longer applicable or available. So that's interesting. And obviously, we've also talked about the fact that I think it is winter now. I think we can safely say that, it's super cold outside, wet, miserable, not that nice, very windy, you know, pretty much the winter in the UK, I guess, really. So we'll give you a few flying tips, because you can still fly, you know, if the rain does stop and the wind calms down, it's still possible to get some great flying weather. So just preparing for the cold, I think, is what we'll talk about there. So hopefully a useful episode as well. So let's kick off with the first subject then. So we will talk about Flock drone insurance. And me and Matthew will just kind of bounce it between us, actually, realistically. We've got a couple of bullet points to talk through. So if you don't know what Flock is, or what Flock were, I guess, they kind of shook up the industry, I guess. I remember when I was teaching the course, we used to talk about the sort of the two big companies, and we'll mention them a little bit later on. And then I don't know when it was. I probably should have maybe looked it up, but it was at least 2 or 3 years ago. I think Flock appeared, and everyone was like, "Who are these? You know, Flock. I've never heard of it before." And the best thing about their company was the fact that they actually kind of initiated the pay-as-you-go drone insurance. So for a long time, students would have to pay a set price for their course. They'd then have to pay the CAA for their application, a little bit like how they did it or how they have to now. But on top of that, the CAA would also want an insurance policy in place too, as part of their submission, which I don't think is the case now, actually. So that's interesting. And obviously, there was only a couple of insurance companies to choose from, and they all did yearly policies. So you had to take out a yearly policy straight away just to get your license, even if you had no jobs or anything else in the pipeline. So it was a huge expense, really, because the average policy back then was about £400 or so. So it was another outlay, even before you knew you had any work, potentially. So that was why Flock were sort of straight away like, oh, okay, so you can do pay-as-you-go insurance. You can sign up for them for almost nothing. And then you literally just have to pay as you fly, which was great for a lot of people. So I think that's where they really shook up the industry and really gained traction, I think, which was really, really good. And that was the sort of the biggest thing. And I think it really did change the industry for the better, because, like I say, back then the PFCO course was £1,500. CAA fee, 250-ish, I would say, and then obviously 400 on top of that for the insurance. It really was expensive, and obviously as soon as Flock came along, you could get rid of that £400 initial payment and sort of insure yourself as you go. So do you remember, Matthew, when they sort of came on the scene? I don't know whether that was probably around your sort of time when you kind of started with us, I suppose, or I don't know, actually.
Yeah, Tom, as far as I recall, Flock were in the mix from the time when I joined UAV Hub, and that's a couple of years ago now. But I think sort of leading on from what you've discussed already as well, I think Flock probably foresaw a little bit of a shift in the market in that at that time, or perhaps a little bit before that time, I think most of the commercial work was done by rather large entities with big aircraft and a sort of quite an operation. These days, of course, with the regulations having developed and the equipment having developed and become really high quality in sort of small packages, I think the industry now opens itself to a much wider array of people who have small, relatively economical aircraft, and of course, who aren't necessarily committing their full career to this. They sort of start doing it part-time, etc. So this is something I often talk to with students passing through their flight test. At the end of the flight test, obviously, we talk a little bit about the operations manual, which we're yet to create for them, and I talk about the insurance and suggest to them that in a lot of cases the pay-as-you-fly type policy makes most sense. I think that sort of shift in mindset, as you say, was beneficial to the industry as a whole, and it certainly made some of the other big names in the industry side of things change their operation and accommodate themselves and will be more accommodating to people in that position as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was, you know, another benefit for the consumer, I think, as well, because like you said, obviously, if you've got a large business, then maybe those outgoings aren't a huge amount. But if you're on your own and you've just almost spent the same again on an aircraft, you know, it does start to get a little bit ridiculous, I think, actually, with how much money you've got to kind of put on the line before you kind of know what's going to happen, actually. So that was kind of, I think, yeah, the light bulb moment for them, maybe, I suppose. Yep. And obviously another good thing is they had this app as well. So again, I think maybe the other insurance companies did have maybe that sort of side of things, but it wasn't anything to write home about, I don't think. Whereas the Flock app was incredible, because you'd put in exactly where you were going to fly, it would draw a bubble around the area, it would then analyze the area with their sort of risk mitigation or risk kind of score, I guess, really. And you would pay, it all depended on the risk score. If it was a high risk, if you were flying, you know, in controlled airspace or near a school or in a built-up area, you'd get a high risk score, and so you'd have to pay a bit more. If you're on your own in the middle of a field, it could be as cheap as about £2, I think, for like an hour's flight. So it was really clever in that respect, because it was almost doing a risk assessment on your behalf, which I think was really good. And I wonder, and we'll get onto this a little bit later, whether they were using the drone community as kind of a test bed, I suppose, just seeing how the app worked, how that then kind of resulted in risks and accidents and payouts, and potentially testing the waters for what they've now moved into, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. So I think that was really good as well. It felt like, yeah, this is kind of how it should be, really, rather than, you know, just paying a certain amount of money for any type of flights that you
for
might
sure.
be doing.
Yeah. Definitely. Tom, I think sort of in principle, that just makes absolute sense. I mean, if you find yourself in the middle of a field having a bit of fun and you'd like to have your equipment insured for the safety of the equipment itself, for example, then I think that's absolutely ideal because you'll be paying a really reasonable amount of money to do so rather than, as you say, committing to several hundred pounds for an extremely low risk set of circumstances. So yeah, that was an incredible sort of thought process that they went through.
Which again, none of us really thought about because we just kind of went along with the yearly policy because that's all that was available. So it's funny how, you know, people come along or companies come along and sort of shake up the market. I'm always a big fan of that because sometimes tradition is a bit annoying. You know, we do things because it's always been done like that, but no one really ever stops to think, why are we doing things like that? You know, it takes someone to sort of almost gamble, I think, which I think is always really exciting. So yeah, the industry then changes. So we'll now go back to kind of why maybe it happened or what are they doing now. And so I think basically a lot of customers got an email, I think it was last week or so, basically just explaining out of the blue, we're not doing drone insurance anymore. I think policies that were still in place were still valid up until the end of their kind of cutoff date. So you're not suddenly just thrown out into the dark and that's it, you've got no insurance. So I think they're still keeping insurance running up until people's kind of cutoff date, which is good. But that was all they said, really. It was like, no, we're not doing drone insurance anymore. We're going to, you know, like I say, keep your policy running, but that's pretty much it. Thank you for being a customer and almost goodbye. Yes, Matthew, yeah.
Yeah, Tom, just for clarity, I think also just so that there isn't any confusion, they did also offer the full policy as well. So that's the reason for people still having a sort of period of time that would be outstanding otherwise. As you say, as far as I understand, those policies will still be current, yeah.
That's right, yeah. So they did pay as you go, but they also did sort of yearly policies as well, if you wanted one of those too, exactly, yeah. Yeah. So that's all they said. And straight away, as a student sort of told us that, I thought, oh, you know, Flock have, you know, gone bust or something. You know, they haven't been making enough money and something's happened. And Matt Williams kind of chimed in a bit and he said, oh, well, they were only looking for more employees a few weeks ago, so I'd find that quite strange. So we quickly logged on and went to the Flock website, and no, they're still there, but they're moved into car insurance now, or commercial car insurance. So quite a different strategy and a different kind of sector, I suppose. But maybe the drone sector is too small for them, or they were using it as a test case. So obviously, if you imagine the amount of people that fly a drone, quite small in the grand scheme of things, I would say, and the amount of people that fly commercially is probably even smaller. So you could imagine that the pool of people that they're sort of getting money from, I suppose, really is pretty small. Whereas if you think about commercial car insurance, that's massive, isn't it? It's a huge industry, yeah, which must be worth so much more. And I think personally, this is me talking now, that they were maybe testing the waters. Yes, the app is great, people love it, it works really well, it's a really good way of analyzing risk, and so they're literally implementing that whole kind of idea now into the commercial car industry. What do you think, Matthew? Do you think that's a sort of a potentially what happened?
Yeah, quite possibly. I think you'd get realistic data from having worked in a different sector potentially and being able to work with that data and interpret it. So, of course, that's a huge part of what insurers do. They've got actuaries lined up by the dozen, I think, figuring out how they're going to cover themselves at the same time as they're covering you. So that's quite possibly the case. And I think, as you say, they specifically seem to be talking about the commercial side of the motor industry, as far as I understand, rather than the masses. And that makes sense, that it's sort of a core group of clients that I think they'll be able to understand well. So certainly it'll be very interesting to see how they progress. I think in that market, they will find themselves up against a lot more competition because I think there's a lot more insurers in that segment. Yeah. But hopefully they're on a good footing to be able to make a success of it and upscale their business into that platform.
Yeah, for sure, because I've noticed now a lot of insurance companies are starting to use your mobile phone as sort of like a how safe are you driving type of thing. So I imagine the app is doing something very similar. Some of the screenshots I've seen, it almost seems to analyse your journey and kind of put it in red if you've been a little bit, I don't know, excitable, can we put it? I don't know, something like that, or a little bit dangerous, something like that. And then obviously green and yellow. And so it analyses the route and then obviously potentially then I imagine then charges you for that journey instead of just a one-off payment for the year. So again, it's a clever idea. And I think with all the other car manufacturers moving towards automation and stuff like that, I think we will be kind of charged for how safe we are on the road, because it makes sense, doesn't it, really? Just because I've got a certain car, it doesn't mean I'm going to be, you know, a certain level of skill or not, as the case may be. And I think if it can analyse you as a person, you'll get a bespoke quote, I suppose, really, too, which is really good. I guess this might be going slightly off topic, so maybe we'll steer it back to drone aircraft. But I think that's basically what's happened to Flock. They've gone into that industry. The good thing is, though, for us, it's not game over. There's still plenty of other companies to sort of choose from. Matthew, you've got a couple on screen. What are your views even on those?
So, yeah, as you say, there are a couple of names which I suppose we could call the big names in the insurance game for industries. They're just sort of the names that we often recommend from having had positive experiences with them ourselves before. And the three that come to mind are CoverDrone, Moonrock, and Towergate. I think CoverDrone is probably the best known industry insurer within the industry. They also do a phenomenal service, and they also do the pay as you fly as well. So yeah, the others that we've mentioned, Moonrock and Towergate, are also well-known names that are also very, very good. And of course there's a list as long as your arm of people who are offering insurance, but I think it depends on your requirements, the type of flying you're doing. I know some people are trying to insure their equipment, and perhaps their sort of photographic equipment as well as their drone equipment, and that seems to have been something which has been difficult for some people in the past, to have a single policy that covers that. So I think these couple that we've mentioned seem to be able to offer more perhaps than what others do, but of course it really depends on your personal needs, so you'll need to talk to several and get a couple of quotes before making your choice.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, and we've always kind of pushed people towards CoverDrone, you know, ever since we began, actually, back in sort of 2014. CoverDrone were kind of there at the beginning, so it was kind of good that they're still carrying on and they're still kind of adapting what they do and offering, you know, shorter term policies, which obviously they probably had to when Flock turned up. And obviously Moonrock are there too. We always recommend Moonrock too, and Towergate as a third option. But obviously a quick Google, a quick sort of price comparison. Do they do a price comparison for drone insurance, I wonder? Is that a meerkat option? I don't know. It always makes me annoyed when I see their stupid adverts, but or confused for drone insurance. I'm not sure. Have you seen anything like that, Matthew?
Well, all of a sudden we've just realised why they exist, haven't we? I haven't seen that specifically. I can't say from experience, but I wouldn't be surprised if somebody's doing it out there.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's an idea. I should have put a patent on that, shouldn't I? God damn it, but I'm sure someone's already thinking about that already, I imagine. But a quick Google search, you'll find the top companies. But like I say, yeah, see what quotes you can get, I suppose, for what you actually need. So I think that's pretty much everything with regards to Flock. I'm not sure if there's anything else to mention there, but just an interesting piece of news, I suppose, really. So yeah, there we go. I think we've covered that off quite nicely. So we'll move on to the second part of the episode now. And this is all to do with winter. Obviously, as we've mentioned, it is getting much colder now. And we need to sort of prepare ourselves even, because obviously we're going to be outside. We're going to be outside for a period of time. Probably not really moving around too much, so you know, the cold will set in quite quickly. And we've kind of grouped these tips into sort of two different areas. So we're going to talk about ourselves to start with, so pilot tips, before then moving on to the aircraft side of things. So yeah, I guess let's make a start with some top tips for pilots then, shall we? So Matthew, do you want to go through a couple of the first ones and draw on any experience that you've got as well, actually, if you'd like to?
Yes, certainly I can, Tom. And my experience is very fresh because I was out yesterday, as I mentioned earlier. So yeah, yesterday as an example, I think the ground temperature was something around, or the air temperature at on site was around 4 degrees or so. But we did have a very strong wind. So I think if we take that into account, we were probably sitting, I think the weather apps were saying something in the region of 0 or -1, sort of the real feel, as they call it. So yeah, we were in, I don't want to say extreme conditions, but certainly not very comfortable conditions. And the first thing that we need to talk about is, it's a standard thing that we all need to do every day, is just to keep warm. So basically have enough layers of suitable clothing to be able to keep your body, and particularly your feet as well. I always found that my feet are the most sensitive and difficult thing to keep warm. So you just need to be equipped for that, so that you can function comfortably and not be shivering and worrying and distracted by that all the time. Of course, gloves are crucial. All of your extremities are always vulnerable, so gloves are crucial. But of course, for model flying and for drone flying, it is difficult to wear gloves because you need to have that sensitivity in your hands and in your fingers to be able to control the aircraft nicely. So there's a couple of ways around that. A lot of people do use fingerless gloves. I think that is a possibility. Tom, I think you've mentioned before previously that that doesn't sit very well with you. You haven't sort of felt very comfortable with any kind of gloves on your hands while you're flying. So I think there's an alternate that you've used previously in a sort of a container or a mitt or a sort of cover for the transmitter itself, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right. So I've always been used to flying just with my bare hands, basically. And anytime I wear any type of gloves or even fingerless gloves, it still just doesn't really feel right. And I just feel like I've got some sort of barrier and no tactile feeling, if that makes sense. So it's one of those things that, you know, puts you out of your comfort zone straight away before you've even started to fly, which is obviously not ideal. So one of the things that I did or have used and really found it very good indeed, it's something called like a transmitter. It's almost like a hood or like a mitt that goes around the whole entire transmitter itself. And I think they have been called a transmitter muff as well, which is an interesting name. And you can find it if you do search for that. Trust me, I'm not joking. It is also called that as well. Yeah. But obviously be careful with what you search for there. But it really does work incredibly well. It's like I say, a fleece-lined sort of hood that contains your hands, the controller and everything. And you've also got a little Perspex window in the front so you can see everything. But then you've got the best of both worlds. You've got a warm pair of hands. You've got that tactile feeling as well. And it almost feels like, you know, it isn't cold anymore, which is incredible, really useful. And if it is even colder, you can then sort of put hand warmers in there as well, and kind of it like cocoons everything in a nice warm environment, I suppose. Really, and the good thing is, if you've got a smart device too, that will also be kept warm. So maybe the battery will last longer potentially, and everything is kind of then sort of kept at a nice sort of much warmer temperature. So I definitely recommend those myself. They're not very much; they're about £10-15 actually. And again, they might have developed slightly better ones and more specific ones, depending on what aircraft you fly. But yeah, really good little tip there, I suppose, for that side of things. And talking about hand warmers as well, I guess we also want to mention those too. So the little crackable ones that you can sort of crack and they'll start to warm up, obviously a great idea to put them in your pockets, and then anytime you're not flying, keep your hands in your pockets, and that'll warm your hands back up again straight away. As soon as they get cold, like Matthew was saying, you know, you're useless basically. If you can't move your fingers properly and you can't move your thumbs, you know, you're not really a pilot anymore. So keeping your hands warm and having ways to warm them up as well in between flights is obviously super important as well. So the hand warmers are a great tip. You can keep sort of a couple in your flight bag. That's what we used to do. So that way, if we suddenly then thought, God, yeah, it's a little bit colder than we thought, or even if your feet get cold, put them in your socks, and you know, that'll help as well. It's, you know, really good little thing to have with you there. And I think some of them are reusable as well, which I think is pretty handy too. Matthew's mentioned layers as well, so obviously really important there, especially if you're going to get wet. Obviously, if you get wet and you're cold, it's even worse then. So trying to make sure you've got waterproofs as well is important. And just maybe a spare set of clothes. If you're going to be out all day, you know, you never know what's going to happen. So like we've always talked about, planning is the best thing. So just plan for the worst. Assume it's going to get really cold, it's going to rain, and you know, you're going to be miserable. If you can kind of sort of fix all of those three issues before they appear, then hopefully you won't have any problems either, which is also good too. Yeah, a couple of things left, Matthew, there.
Yeah, that's right. I think crucially, one of the most important ones, which we haven't specifically said yet, is to actually take some breaks as well. So give yourself that relief from the conditions. If you can get into a sheltered area, that may be a vehicle, it may be, I don't know, a hut or something similar, which you can just shelter in, take a few minutes to have a cup of tea or coffee and recover, and just warm yourself up again and sort of get yourself comfortable again. That way, each time you head out into the cold, you're sort of refreshed and ready to take it on, and not sort of slowly but surely sort of dropping into a worse and worse state through a period of time. So I think those breaks are absolutely crucial. And sort of just touching back on yesterday, that's exactly what we did. Of course, our activity sort of goes in heats. We have a couple of races and then a break and a couple of races while the others are busy racing. We're inside warming up and sorting our equipment out and so on. And that worked perfectly. So I spent basically all of the sunlight hours that we had yesterday, or the daytime hours, should I say, there was very little sunlight out on site. And at no time was I ever sort of thinking to myself, this is uncomfortable, this is potentially getting to a stage where I could be, you know, sort of coming to some harm. At no point whatsoever. We were actually all comfortable throughout the day. And I'm talking about a group of sort of 12 or 15 people. Nobody seemed to be shivering or struggling. It wasn't extreme conditions, but it certainly was a result of the fact that we were all following this guidance that we've been talking about today.
Okay, so I think that's the kind of pilot taken care of now. So let's move on to the aircraft, which obviously is almost as important, because obviously just you being cold isn't going to be dangerous. But, well, not on your own, I guess, but with the aircraft in the mix, obviously that's when it all starts to get a little bit more dangerous and a bit more worrying, I suppose, really. So let's talk about what you can do to keep the aircraft in the air and safe for as long as possible. So I think the biggest thing that we need to talk about here is essentially the batteries. We all know that batteries just don't like the cold, and especially if it's on a drone, obviously they're a lot more important than if they're just on a phone or in your car or something like that. So the biggest thing is to try and keep the batteries warm. That's the most important thing. So if they get cold, it's kind of harder to kind of warm them up. So try and keep them warm at all times. If you don't, obviously, nowadays the aircraft, I think, will actually warn you that the batteries are colder. So that's always quite interesting. But if they don't, then obviously you're going to get a much shorter flight time. And also, you'll get something called voltage drop-off as well. So you might be flying along at sort of 40, 30%, and then suddenly, because the battery is very cold, the voltage will drop like it's at 0%, and you won't get any warning, and the aircraft will either start to land on its own or try and return home, but then fail and then land on its own as well. So it can all be quite stressful and problematic. So you've probably seen a few of those instances, Matthew, potentially.
Yes, we have. Of course, as hobbyists, some guys are much more careless than a professional operator and just sort of, you know, put an aircraft together and head out and fly it. And I've actually got a friend out in Canada who moved out there in quite recent time, and he just took his models with him and set them up as he always had done. And he went out and flew in some pretty extreme conditions compared to what we're likely to see here. And interestingly, exactly what you're talking about, Tom, very, very quickly, he had a LiPo battery strapped to the outside of a model. And because of the airflow and the prop blast and so on, the battery got very cold very quickly, and it literally just stopped working and everything shut off, and it dropped like a stone. So that's an extreme case, but it's an example of what can happen. So I think one of the things that we need to understand about warming the batteries is that it's important that the battery is warm throughout. It doesn't help that we just, for example, if we were to give it a blast with a hairdryer on the outside, the casing may feel warm, but internally the cells would still be cold. So when you pop them in your pockets to warm them up, it's important that they spend some time there. And of course, we do need to be careful of shorting out the terminals. So obviously do that carefully. Don't have your keys in your pocket touching against the terminals, for example. But yeah, I think having them in your pocket for a decent amount of time before flying is another little additional tip to go along with just saying have them in your pocket.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because they're quite a big mass, aren't they? Think of them like, a stone or a large lump of metal, and think how long it would take to kind of warm up that whole bit of metal, kind of just with skin contact. It would be a good sort of half an hour, I would say, realistically.
You would have thought so. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. If it's a cold morning, when you're getting all your stuff ready, put your battery straight into your pockets and almost forget about them. You know, have them in an inside pocket, and by the time you've driven somewhere, you've got to location, they'll be as warm. Like I've said, they're already room temperature in your house, so keeping them there is actually much easier than kind of reheating up a stone cold battery that you might have left in the car overnight or something like that. So try and be on top of that. The aircraft then, actually, once it's in the sky and you're flying it, the current draw actually then will keep the battery warm anyway. So you then probably won't notice any difference in flight time, which is really interesting. But initially, that's when it will be a problem. So another quick tip is, once your batteries are warm and they're in your pockets, don't then install it onto an aircraft and then start doing your pre-flight checks, then start doing your paperwork, because the battery is going to get cold very quickly. So the last thing you do, I would say, is install the battery, turn it on, wait till it's happy, take off and start flying. Don't leave it sitting there for a long time, because again, the battery will start to cool down very quickly because it has no amp draw to sort of keep that temperature or keep that internal temperature too. Is that sort of correct, Matthew?
Yeah, I would follow that guidance exactly. I think that's ideal. Obviously, we need to sort of stick to our checklist and not miss any steps, sort of rushing the battery in by any means. But exactly as you say, put that towards the end of your checklist. You're certainly not going to be taking off without the battery installed. So there's not much risk of a failure as a result of that. But yeah, as you say, include it in the sort of final steps just before taking off.
Yeah, exactly. And I think some people might think, oh, this sounds a bit too much. You know, I've never had a problem before. But obviously, I've done quite a few OEs now, and a lot of them have been in the winter. And I had this exact problem. Someone had a unique, I think it was a Typhoon H, actually. So it was one of the little mini hexes. And again, I think he was one of the first OEs of the day. Very cold day. Again, it was sort of frosty on the ground. I arrived on site. His aircraft was already set up, battery installed, you know, not switched on. And he'd said, oh, I've been here for about an hour. I'm ready to go, which is, you know, great. We encourage that, don't we, Matthew? You know, we want people to be ready and raring to go. And we went through everything that we needed to. We powered up the aircraft. Everything was fine. He took off, got it to about kind of 20 feet up into the air, did the pre-flight checks and the control checks. Everything was good. He then maneuvered the aircraft off towards the first location and suddenly got a battery warning straight away within about 30 seconds. And he looked at the controller. The controller still said sort of 90% battery. So it was really strange. And the aircraft did start to land and switched off. He went back to the aircraft, had a look at it, and the battery warning had gone. And so we were like, oh, well, the battery isn't empty. And we thought, what's happened? And it was basically that the battery temperature, he said that, oh, yeah, well, the aircraft sat there for about half an hour before we took off. And so I thought, OK, well, it's got to be the battery temperature then, hasn't it? So he removed the battery. And I said, actually, a good trick is to actually put it in your armpit. It does sound ridiculous, but it's a really quick way of getting heat into the battery. So he did that carefully. We had a chat for about, you know, 5-10 minutes. That was all it actually took. We put the battery back into the aircraft, took off, and the flight lasted for 20 minutes with no problems whatsoever. So it was literally just that. And so he'd never seen that before. You see, that's the strange thing. And because the aircraft will have a battery warning in the sky, as soon as you land it, that'll go away, because obviously then the battery isn't under any stress, and it knows that it really does have its capacity back in the battery again. You see, there's two different kind of things working. It's the capacity that it thinks it's got, but then there's also the voltage it's monitoring as well. And if there's a discrepancy, the voltage will always kind of win. So it'll always think, oh, voltage is low, too cold, let's land instead. So it's an interesting one. So yeah, keep the battery warm, install it quickly, and then take off, and you shouldn't have any problems, which is the main thing. I think just before we carry on talking about this, then we probably want to mention the newer aircraft that can actually self-heat the battery, which I think is really clever. It's one of the things that obviously most electric cars have now, and it's almost imperative, otherwise they wouldn't work, especially in these conditions. And it's the Mavic Enterprise, I think, that can do it, and also the Inspire 2 and probably the Matrice line as well. So I did a quick little bit of research, and it's quite interesting actually how it does it. If you power on the aircraft, the system will heat the battery kind of on its own. As long as the battery is over 50% and it's cold enough, the battery will start heating. You can induce it yourself with the battery just sort of on its own by holding the button down for a bit longer. It'll do certain light flashing sort of indications to tell you if it's heating the battery, if it's maintaining the battery temperature. It's really clever, actually. And I thought, oh, this is good. It's sort of another benefit of having, you know, those aircraft, I guess, if you're flying in those conditions too. But the best thing is to refer to the manual or just search on YouTube. I found plenty of sort of walkthrough videos of what the lights mean and how long it'll keep the battery warm for, and stuff like that. Obviously, if you are just using it as a heater while it's not charged, or while it's not charging, I should say, obviously you are going to be decreasing your flight time, because obviously it's got to find the energy from somewhere. So just bear that in mind too. But another cool option. The only thing I don't know is whether you can buy Mavic Enterprise batteries and use them in the normal Mavic. I wonder if it lets you do that or not, because that would be quite a benefit, wouldn't it? But I've got no idea, actually.
I can comment sort of, and I certainly wouldn't like to stake my life on it, but I know for a fact that we have used Mavic 2 batteries in a Mavic 2 Enterprise. I helped somebody out with a couple of additional batteries for their flight test. So they certainly are compatible to a certain level, but whether or not they're capable of doing that, the self-discharge, I'm not sure. I would assume that the same circuitry is used for the sort of long-term storage discharge, which the Mavic 2 batteries do. For the preheat, I think they probably use a similar system, but you'd have to clarify with your specific model and be certain of the functionality for sure before going ahead and using that. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I think because the battery can kind of almost do it on its own, I would assume that kind of all the technology is in the battery. It's not maybe in the aircraft. Yeah. So I would bet a few pounds on the fact that you might get away with that. I don't know, but it'd be a good
careful
test,
somebody
actually
might come claiming that from you, Tom.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm just gonna, you know, just gently bet on that. I think is probably the best thing to say there. But no, it would be interesting if anyone's got that experience. Then if you can let us know, it'd be interesting to know. You can always email us at podcast@uavhub.com and let us know about that. That'd be interesting. Cool. Okay, so that's all the battery side of it. I would say really the battery side of it is the most important and probably the largest subject, realistically. But there is one more subject that we have to talk about, which is also as important, I would say, and that's with icing. So icing can happen, and if you've gone through any of our learning, we do talk about icing on propellers, most importantly, but obviously on the aircraft it can happen too. And interestingly, ice can form anywhere from 5 degrees under, so it doesn't have to be freezing, which is what a lot of people I think assume to start with. But it can happen at sort of, you know, +5 all the way down to, you know, sort of negative numbers as well. So maybe Matthew, you could sort of expand on that a little bit more before we kind of wrap up.
Yes, Tom, for sure. I think in recent time, we actually had a post on one of our Facebook pages, which spoke about somebody who'd had icing in recent time. And of course, the temperatures haven't really been below zero much recently. So I think that's a clear indication that it can happen. And of course, the reason why it's happening is that the propellers are not stationary. They're moving quickly through the air and adding in that movement, which of course is the wind chill factor, which we feel as people on the ground. So the propellers are exposed to quite a bit more extreme conditions than the rest of the aircraft. So it's very likely that icing would start there. And of course, the real problem is that any form of ice buildup on the blades changes the profile of the blades and effectively the lift that they generate. So, and that's, of course, what causes the problem. So we're not talking about propellers falling off as a result of cracking due to the cold or something like that. We're talking about the physical shape of the propeller being affected by the ice and affecting the performance of the aircraft as a result. This is a real thing that happens. I think it is quite rare. It doesn't happen very often, but it certainly is a factor to consider and has caused incidents, I think, in the past as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think remembering back a few years ago, I think one of our flight instructors, Jamie Allen up in Glasgow, he sent some pictures back to us of a flight that he did, and he landed, and yeah, there was ice actually on the Mavic propellers. Very small amount, but it was there. So obviously, again, if it had been a longer flight, that could have affected it and, you know, could have been a problem potentially. I think it's worse, as we've said, on bigger aircraft. I think the bigger the aircraft, the more it can happen. So the smaller the aircraft, obviously I'm talking about full size here, not just larger drones, but drones themselves do have the same issue, but maybe to a lesser extent, I suppose. But it's something to be aware of. And what we recommend if that could be a problem. So I would say if you're flying in any type of conditions that are under 5 degrees, do very short flights. Come back, land the aircraft, check it over, wipe it down, put it in the air again. Don't send the drone off for 45 minutes or something without checking it, because obviously then 45 minutes of ice buildup is obviously worse than a couple of minutes instead. So short flights are key. And obviously that might tie in with you keeping warm as well, I suppose, too. So another benefit there, too, I guess, as well. So, obviously the last thing, obviously, that we need to prepare or to sort of, I suppose, talk through is just the fact that obviously all this depends on the type of flight you're doing. And obviously, if you're just flying around in a field on your own, obviously, if the aircraft does have an issue and you do have an accident, then it's not really going to affect anyone, is it? It's going to be a bit sad for yourself because you've lost your aircraft potentially, but I wouldn't call that sort of a dangerous flight. However, if you're flying in a built-up area with lots of people, then obviously all of this is even more important, because again, if the aircraft lets go, you might actually hurt someone. So I would say much more cautious flying would be needed if you are flying in those conditions. So hopefully that kind of makes a bit of sense too. And that's kind of what you were alluding to, Matthew, I think, wasn't it, actually, too?
Yeah, very much so. That's right. I think obviously it's an expensive lesson to go through if you end up losing an aircraft as a result of any of the factors that we've spoken about. But ultimately, all of the regulations and everything that we teach goes about keeping everybody safe and not finding yourself in a situation where you could be blamed of having operated negligently. So I think considering these factors eliminates that, and making conscious decisions and the right decisions about these factors is very important. So yeah, I think obviously if you are insured, it's important to prove to your insurer that you weren't taking unnecessary risk if you needed to make a claim. And if you hadn't made any consideration, then potentially you may find yourself in hot water trying to get a payout.
Yeah, or maybe cold water, we could say.
Yeah, you may find yourself frozen.
There we go. And I think that's probably a good place to sort of finish the episode there on that amazing
joke. It's getting worse for sure, let's stop.
That's right. Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks very much for listening, everyone. Again, as always, make sure you subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review if you haven't already. Obviously, we appreciate anything that you say there on that front there. Also... Before I lose my voice, we'll obviously ask if you can tell a friend as well. If you've got other people that aren't listening, then obviously that'll all help kind of us get the episodes out there and, again, educate people and hopefully entertain them at the same time as well. And that's it. So, Matthew, it's goodbye from you.
Yeah, it's goodbye from me. Looking forward to the one of the episodes coming up soon. I think something we've spoken about for some time is having a couple more of the guys within the team on. And everybody's heard of Tim. Nobody's really seen Tim, and he hasn't been on the podcast. We look forward to having him on soon as well.
Yeah, I think the idea is to have him on towards the end of the year. So we've got a couple more episodes coming out, I think, before Christmas, and we'll have him on the Christmas episode. Let's call it the Christmas episode. We'll just have a bit of a chat through kind of how the year's gone and sort of any bits and pieces that Tim wants to go over, sort of questions and answers and stuff as well. So hopefully that should be a nice episode with the four of us as well. So without further ado, it's goodbye from me as well. Fly safe and blue skies, everyone. See you later.